Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Building the Diagnostic Center at UTMB for All of Healthcare. The presenter is Michael Lapiceta, Professor and Chair of Pathology, University of Texas Medical Branch, Galveston, Galveston, Texas.
My name is Modena Henderson, and I'm with Beyond Results, LLC, a new consulting firm that focuses on healthcare and laboratories. But today, I have the pleasure of introducing one of my great mentors, a great thinker outside of the box. I love that. Dr. Michael Lapiceta. He is the professor and chair of pathology at University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. So, Dr. Lapiceta, welcome.
Oh, boy. How nice to see friends. I'll tell you, this is terrific. So this story begins in 1983. I was a resident at Washington University, and there was an internal medicine resident, smart guy. It was March, so we'd all been interns for 8 months. And there was a boy who needed a tonsillectomy, and he had a prolonged PTT, a lab test for clotting. And he said, I'm about to give a unit of plasma to this little boy. And I said, Clay, you know that one out of 20 bags has HIV in it, 1983. And he said, yeah, I know. But is there something else that prolongs the PTT other than a bleeding disorder? I said, oh, my, yes. I said, why don't we find out the cost for the prolonged PTT? I said, by the way, do you know what an anti-nuclear antibody elevation means? He said, no idea. I asked him a few more questions, and then he said, look, we guess at everything. I said, wow, this is really kind of an amazing story, right? So you're guessing at all the lab tests. I said, but you don't guess at anatomic pathology findings. If somebody says it's breast cancer or malignant, it automatically went to somebody before it got to you that said malignant breast cancer, and then everybody knew what to do. And I said, here's the problem. The lab test part is getting bigger and bigger and more confusing. So now 40 years have passed. And the most exciting part of this story is what happened in the last 6 months. So that's what this is about. So I have a few disclosures. I'm director of this diagnostic center at UTMB. We got a $9 million grant, and we used it to do what I'm going to tell you about. I'm on the scientific advisory board for Warfarin Lewis and founding member of a company that's connected to the diagnostic center called Expert Diagnostic Colleague. So here's the outline. I'm going to say briefly about the state of affairs in diagnostic medicine. I'm going to talk about this recognition of making a mistake in diagnosis because of lab tests. We'll talk about the challenges in fixing the problems, the attempts to provide a solution, and then I'm going to tell you about the current activities that allow us to provide an answer for literally everybody who's sick in this country. Everybody who has a bleeding or clotting disorder, we can handle them all. And it's not competing with testing. We're doing the interpretation part. We are doing what has been going on in anatomic pathology and what's been going on in radiology for a long time. And, in fact, we're engaging with radiology in a brand new way, which you'll see. Okay, here's the state of affairs. I was born in 1952. Back in 1952, the amount of knowledge is in the blue circle at the top. So there were about 3 coagulation disorders. So that meant if you're a really good doctor, and you, this is how much you know in red, you knew most of what there was in medicine because there simply weren't that many facts. But, you know, there were a few doctors who knew a little bit less. But here's what happened. What happened is you can't draw the circle big enough. Right? More than 10,000 tests. Cystic fibrosis, goodness. It was one disease until 1989. And then in 1989, they found the gene for cystic fibrosis. And then since that time, there have been so many varieties that it's now six different diseases treated six different ways. One is male infertility. We think of cystic fibrosis with coughing, right? Male infertility, somebody who's 35 years old and can't have children, what's that? You have cystic fibrosis. Really? Yes, because now that we've found 2,000 different mutations in the gene, we found out you can get sick with cystic fibrosis in a lot of different ways. So even our best professors have a lot of blue space. They don't know, right? So what are we going to do about the blue space? We could send them through this maze, good luck, right? I mean, figure out all that. Just order all 10,000 tests. Somebody will be in your office. We want to create a ramp. And we want to create a ramp to those people at the top who can say, okay, I know exactly what you have. And it isn't going to take forever to figure it out, even if it's porphyria cutanea tarda. So we're beginning to understand that diagnostics have to be integrative. The National Academy of Medicine has these interest groups that put out, I should say specialty groups, that put out a report saying this is the status of a certain set of diseases. And they had one for cancer, integrative diagnostics for cancer, and they bring in a few people to speak, and I got to speak at this one, and I showed them this slide. And I said that, really, if you have somebody who has cancer, the clinician is going to see that maybe they have blood in the urine, but it's going to require somebody in radiology to do a CAT scan to see the kidney, and then you're going to have to biopsy it, and then you're going to have to do a bunch of lab tests. So really, we can't think of diagnostics if we're really going to solve it in the way we have before, where the anatomic pathologist says, I looked at the slide, it's hepatitis, not hepatoma. Good luck with that. Handing it to my primary care doctor, along with a bunch of lab tests, and now genetic lab tests. My doctor, by the way, is a 5 out of 5 star doctor at UTMB. There are only 11 of them. But if you ask her something genetic, she'll say, I really don't know what a nucleotide is. I don't know what an allele is. Oh, man. Then you really can't figure out my pharmacogenomics, can you? So this is a 5 star doctor, and she's good, and I respect her. See, here's somebody who has a clot. Well, how did this thing happen? Why did you get a clot? One of the reasons you could get a clot is you have cancer, right? So here's a group of our experts who say, wait a minute, is it cancer? There's blood in the urine, and the kidney function isn't so good. And then radiology tells us there's a mass, and then anatomic pathology tells us that it's cancer, and then the COAG group comes in and tells the rest of the story and monitors the drug. Woo! Wouldn't that be great if American medicine worked that way? Right? Especially if you lived in West Texas and your hospital was a 200-bed community hospital. Shouldn't that work for everybody? I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, right? So how come we can't? So recognition of the errors. So medical errors is a broad thing. And there was a publication, National Academy of Medicine Group, that talked about what kinds of medical errors are dominant. And so it started with To Err Is Human, which focused on surgical errors, like poking a catheter through the aortic arch during catheterization. Yes, you died. We counted that. And then there were drug errors, where you gave a breast cancer, somebody has breast cancer, you give them 4 times the dose of chemotherapy, and they die because you made a pharmacologic error. And then we showed up, a 21-member committee, I got to be on it, and in that 21-member committee, it was clear that diagnostic error is the biggest thing. You go to your doctor, you are short of breath. And when you go to the doctor and you are short of breath, you could have like 10 different things. So are you short of breath because you have asthma? Maybe. Are you short of breath because you have a clot in your lung? Maybe. Well, those are two hugely different things. And if I give you a nebulizer and think you have asthma and you have a pulmonary embolism and you need an anticoagulant, you can die. So when they counted all those, we came to the conclusion as a committee that every American has been the victim of at least one diagnostic error. I counted my own. I had 10. 10. It started when I was a medical student and I was sick with a bad respiratory infection and I couldn't even make it to the hospital. So I went to a local GP down the street, and class of 1936, University of Maryland. This was in 1974. And I said, I'm really sick. Can you help me? And he gave me something to move my bowels. And I said, I was hoping for an antibiotic. And he said, moving your bowels is good for everything. And that was my first diagnostic error. So you know, when you add this up, we came up with, as the National Academy of Medicine group, with 60,000 people who die preventable deaths. So you add up all the mass shootings, you don't get anywhere near 60,000, right? And so what really brought this forward was something that appeared in late 2023. David Newman Toker is the first author. This was on every news site. And they looked at five diseases, the cancers, heart attack, stroke, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, one more. And they said 800,000 Americans either die or are permanently disabled from a diagnostic error. 371,000 of those were deaths, meaning we were way off at 60,000. We're talking more than 250,000 Americans who die unnecessarily. So this really garnered everybody's attention. And so we have long known that we need help, that your average doctor needs help. What's going on with that patient? I would do these lab tests, and then please send me the results, and I'll tell you what they all mean, and I'll tell you what to do next. We know we need that help, but nobody has figured we could build it, right? It's like, you know, it would just be great if your life could have this problem solved, but how could you possibly build it? So part of the problem is that pathology is a little slow to change, right? Just as anybody else. Remember, this story started in 1983. We didn't have rounds at the Mass General Hospital dealing with coagulation problems, my expertise, for 12 years. It took 12 years just to get it into the hospital. And then the rest of the time, we continued to grow it. But really, if you have artificial intelligence involved, everybody's afraid that, oh no, a machine will read my biopsy. We'll say something about that. Fear of income loss, fear of acquisition of significant new responsibilities, like I need to actually know what all those genes are and what they do. It's pretty clear. This is a paper from Nature, and it just talks about deep learning and histopathology, and this is the percent error. If it's above, it's bad. If it's below, this percent error roughly for this group of pathologists that were studied, and this is what's called shallow learning, but this is when the computer teaches itself, deep learning. Look when this happened. So around 2015, there was information that could be done by instrumentation that could potentially outperform a pathologist. Well, who would go on this airplane? Now, there is a computer in there, and it can fly you from Boston to London, but there are no pilots. Nobody's doing that, right? So here it is with people in the cockpit. This is one of those things. If my wife has a lesion that could be cancer, there is no way I'm going to put it through a machine and say, well, that's that, honey. We are going to have to be able to interface and do what we need to do to make these two things come together. So the other issue is that some people have worried that if they provide advice about which lab test to pick, that maybe then they won't be valuable locally. So many of you have seen this picture. So this is me, right? And I'm tossing over that puzzle piece, and this person is a GYN doctor. And this GYN doctor has somebody who has a factor V Leiden heterozygous mutation. 1 out of 20 Caucasians, right? So several people in this room have factor V Leiden. So the most prothrombotic state, one of the most prothrombotic states is the postpartum state. So you had your baby. Now you got your first month after the baby and you're heterozygous for life. You're going to get an anticoagulant? So you have to. But the trouble is that this doctor here doesn't know that. So it falls to the floor. And then somewhere 2 weeks after having a baby, you can't chase the baby around because you're short of breath because you have a big clot in your lung, right? Oh, that's terrible, right? So why is there a wall? I thought this was really interesting. This came out just last December. There's a study done, why don't you want to be a pathologist? Why is it that 2 or 3% of people graduating from med school want to become a pathologist, right? I asked our assistant chief medical officer, I said, Carlos, you think I'm a pathologist? He said, I know you're chairman of the department, but you're not really a pathologist. I said, why am I not a pathologist? He says, the way I think a pathologist is somebody who does an autopsy and looks through a microscope. You don't do either of those. And I said, so what do you call me? He said, I haven't figured that out yet. So it turns out that we have to think of ourselves as diagnosticians. And we all have to talk. And we have to keep the idea in mind that it's all about the patient. It isn't about, will I get paid for that? Will I get paid for that? Because while we do that, we're making healthcare in America really expensive because it takes too long to get the diagnosis. So that's what I've been suggesting, right, since 1984. We pick up the pieces. We'll tell you, Clay, what's going on with that prolonged PTT. Take down the wall, and I'll tell you what's going on. The kid had a lupus anticoagulant. He was not going to bleed. You didn't have to give him plasma. Quit it already. So the original idea was, look, if you have anatomic pathologists in a hospital, there I was at the Mass General Hospital. We had like 3 lung pathologists, 4 hematopathologists. You could take all the specialties. We had such a big department. I thought, why can't you create all those specialties and make an analogous circumstance for laboratory medicine? So then you could have all the testing, right? And then we can bundle in radiology. Well, it turns out that nobody really thought that was a good idea. And the biggest reason is because in the early 80s, there was a decision made that every doctor could interpret the results of every lab test. Boy, that was a mistake. Yeah, that might have been true in 1982 when they decided they weren't going to pay you to interpret a glucose. But then what happened next, right? So then we got hemoglobin A1Cs, and then suddenly the diagnosis of diabetes got even more complicated. Everything became more complicated. But you know what? We kept the same rules. We're not going to pay you. We're not going to pay you to interpret a lab test. So I couldn't earn my salary. I couldn't earn my salary signing out 30 cases a day at the Mass General that were co-ed. So that was the original idea, and that was the response that took a long time to change. We're about to change that. We're on the precipice. Diagnostic center now is what we're talking about. And we're talking about being able to answer any question. Any question. Cystic fibrosis? My son is engaged to a woman who has phenylketonuria. Really? Phenylketonuria. So I guess that means we need to have an expert team on amino acid metabolic disorders. Because I don't want people to be missed with phenylketonuria. She happened to know it because her brother had it. She was treated from day one, never suffered the effects of mental retardation. I mean, what a huge thing to be able to do, right? The Diagnostic Center is paid for its consultation, and the goal here is that wherever you work, if you're a pathologist and you don't know what it is, you press the button, and then we take over, you'll see this in a minute, until you get the diagnosis. So this is analogous to what you do in anatomic path, right? My brother-in-law got a biopsy, something on his back. Was it a sarcoma? The guy in Tennessee didn't know what it was. He sent the sample, the slide to his friend at the Cleveland Clinic. That took 2.5 weeks. And then finally, after a while, we got the genetics of it. It wasn't a tumor. Okay, so that whole thing took a month. Can't we do the same thing here? So, but we can do it in shorter time. Okay, so the first public medical school west of the Mississippi, there it is. That's we call it Old Red, the John Seeley building. And so this used to just be me and a friend, and now there's like 10 of us. And the average age of this group is probably somewhere in the early 40s. So here's the idea. This is the product. The product is, we're not going to do tests. What we're going to do is establish a diagnosis. And that means we're going to talk to our other friends, right? Really, it's radiology, but AP and CP. There's a little bit of spirometry and EKG along the way, but you got about 98% of the diagnostic information if you can bring these three together. And the treatment is left to the patient-facing provider. I've used the example for those of you who maybe understand the game of football, we used to play both sides, meaning when you're on offense, you had a position. When you were on defense, you still played, right? And you can't do that in medicine today. You're either a diagnostician or you're a provider, treatment provider. It's just too hard to keep up with all of it. So there's no plan to compete with any of the laboratories. Send it to your favorite laboratory. But what we're going to do is we are going to provide this unique service and interpret it all. So how does it all start? You see your doctor. If everything works out fine, that's great. But if it doesn't and you're still coughing and it's been 3 weeks, maybe it's time for you to say, hey, can you help me? Or I have no idea whatsoever. And that brings you here. Now, the difference here is that the way it works right now is we play this diagnostic process like a quiz game. The PTT is prolonged, doctor. What do you want to do? It's a quiz. I know what the answer is. It's a PTT mixing study, right? But I'm going to just test you. And if you pick the wrong one, I'm going to do the wrong test because that's the way it works. That's silly, right? But that is the way it works. So we're going to take over the whole workup. You just give us the patient. We'll tell you which tests you need. Order them from wherever you want. And then we're going to give you a definitive diagnosis and a QR code. And when you go see your doctor the next time, it's going to, we did these tests. And there's the diagnosis at the very bottom. Okay. Attempts to provide a solution. See, you get sick. You got to get a diagnosis. Then you get treated, right? So we all know this story, right? There she is. She asked me to be on her advisory board. Thank God I said no. And then the prosecutor said, will you be the star witness to challenge her? And I said, that's all I'll ever be known for. So I said no both times. So her issue was we lose people too soon because we don't do enough tests. And I hated to get in my blood drawn, so if I get a drop of blood and I can do 100 tests on it, then you won't die soon. Well, that's not the real problem. The real problem is, what do you got? What do those tests mean? So it's leadership in this diagnostic evaluation of patients that's missing. So what are we doing here? So the pandemic shows up. And we get a guy who is now head of artificial intelligence at our institution. And he's got an incredible background. He's a really smart guy. So when we started reading the things about the pandemic, of course there was a PCR test, but from different vendors, and everything was a mess at the beginning. There was an IgG antibody, an IgM antibody. They were done by different methodologies. People were confused by all this. They couldn't figure out false negative because you stick the swab back, you're almost doing a brain biopsy, but the infection's in the lungs. Sometimes you don't get it, so it's a false negative. People really confused about it. So I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read all the diagnostic papers, and I'm going to write as many possible outcomes, like the PCR is positive, the IgM wasn't done, the IgG was done, it was positive, and it was 75 comments. And I said, Peter, could you figure out how to interrogate the EMR, so we have Epic, and then pick the right comment? Because then I could do it in about 5 seconds a case, maybe 10. And if it wasn't quite right, then I'll make a new comment. So we ended up with 150 comments. What happened? Well, let me tell you that what I wrote, the 150 comments, we call that the holy book, to stay non-denominational. And what Peter did is create this automation. So we have three things we have to be able to do with new technology. One is create a holy book. So now you'll see, we can create a holy book in a day. We laid out the 15 holy books we currently have right now. Lipoprotein analysis, diabetes, heart attack, stroke. It's amazing. Then we have to find out when there's new information. That's called literature scraping. And we have to do the automation. So just to lay it all out there, when we interpreted the tests for COVID, so all these different panels, these are how many interpretations we did. We made $20 million. Three people at UTMB made more money than the entire Department of Radiology and all the anatomic pathologists combined. And when we talked to the insurance companies, they said, it's making a difference. And we saw from our statistics, we had a shorter length of stay, and our mortality was lower, no matter how you compared us to anybody. Because people read it on their iPhone. They looked at my chart, and it said, oh, my gosh, I might actually be a false negative. I'm not going to the family reunion. Something happened that made a difference. So we learned how to build a holy book and how to keep it up to date with current findings. I will say that was a manual process, me searching the literature, passed it to somebody who joined our faculty, how to sign out 1,000 cases a day, how to bill for the interpretations. We helped to write some new codes. And then how to do this automated data extraction. And we employed a company, and the company, Biocognive, helped us, because Peter put his together writing all the code. And Biocognive wrote this software. But then we realized we could, that is Peter, could write software to do this for anything. So we meet Mondays from 10 to noon. We've had 31 meetings since September after we got the $9 million. We can now produce a complete holy book on any topic in a single day. So when I saw the one for lipoproteins, I was stunned. There's a bunch of lipoprotein little A comments. I said, what do you got in here for lipoprotein lipase deficiency? There it is. Unbelievable. I said, how did you do it? He said, I know large language models. I can interrogate everything. What do you want me to do? So he's making a new one. He just did thyroid the other day. All Hashimoto's, Graves, you name it, they're all in there. And it can interrogate Epic and point to the right one. Now, we're not going to do this with nobody in the cockpit. We have to be in the cockpit. Those devices can be hallucinatory, right? So you have to know it all makes sense. The automation step, now we do it. Our first one demonstrated was a month ago. Peter took 12 toxicology cases, opioid toxicology, which has comments, and he did them in 10 minutes. They just popped up. This patient isn't taking the meds. They're adulterating the sample by putting in the pill, and there's no metabolite. It figured out everything. And not only that, it picked up the references and said, by the way, this patient's anemic, so it'll interfere with this. Unbelievable. I remember saying, I can't believe what I just saw. Remember, I've been doing this manually for a long time. So those 10 cases would have taken me about 4 hours. So now he did them in 12 minutes. So, and scraping the literature, I'll show you what that means. This is pretty cool. So I said to one of the people on the team, find me all the papers for porphyria in the past year. Zoom. So that pops up. That took 15 seconds. Then I said, find me all the papers about the diagnosis of the porphyrias. So then he sorts it down to another 25 of those. And then I ask him a couple other questions. In my hand are the 6 papers I need to read that would change the comments. Remember, the comments have to change. We are in charge of the holy book. It's not the machine. The machine helps us, but ultimately we get the holy book right. So, selected expert teams and benefits. These are the things all of you, assuming you're all healthy, you need now. And I'm going to convince you why. Pharmacogenetics, you have 26 genes that are responsible for the metabolism of about 280 drugs. So you're going to be using those drugs through your lifetime. Antihypertensives, antidepressants, antiplatelet agents. I mean, Plavix, 1 out of 7 people don't respond to Plavix. You have a heart attack tomorrow, you're going to the hospital, they're giving you Plavix. You want to be 1 out of 7 that doesn't have? That's a really bad idea, right? You should find out now if the Plavix is going to work for your heart attack or your stroke, right? Exome analysis, cancer screening. So I'll do the pharmacogenomics, and I'm going to tell you me. So we send the test out because, again, we're not testing people. So a company does this for us. The ones in yellow, orange, this is my data. And you'll notice I have 7 altered drugs. I can't metabolize a set of drugs because I have an altered gene for cytochrome P450-2C9. And because of that, I suffered renal dysfunction, when they gave me, I had back pain. They said, well, you can take the 200 milligram tablets or you have to do that 4 times a day. We'll give you the 800 milligram tablets. You take them twice a day. So then my renal function started to go to pot. And then when my EGFR got to 50, I said, what the heck is going on? At which point I started doing my own reading and saying, I need pharmacogenomics, right? So what do you get from the company? They give you genetic information. It says 16 nucleotides are missing and da-da-da-da-da. I gave it to my primary care doctor, and Megan says, I can't use this. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to take all the genetic information, and we're going to tell you how to change the dose of the drug so that you could get information that says prescribe less than 40 milligrams. This is for one of the statins. Some statins will work for you. Others won't, based upon your genes, right? So anyhow, we decided that we might do niche testing because the testing from the company that we sent it to, $350 a pop. We can do it for $100. We figured if we do it for $150 and then add on $50 for an intern, for $200, now suddenly everybody starts saying, maybe I will do this, you know? This is the cost of a fancy dinner for 3 or 4. So I'm going to do my own. What really prompted me to think about this and cancer screening was when I took my car in for its 50,000-mile checkup, and they wanted $6,000. And I said, I should spend $6,000 on me, not that car, right? And this is a good reason, right, to find out what drugs will work. Now, I went through this, too, to look at all the risk factors for cancer. And, of course, you'll probably all know it's 90 days if you get pancreatic cancer, diagnosis to death. That's the average, 90 days. So the reason is because we pick it up at stage 4. You don't get sick until you're stage 4. Well, what about stage 1? What about when I have a little mass somewhere in the tail of my pancreas that you could scoop out and send me back to work next week, right? Why can't I find that one? Well, if I had a risk for pancreatic cancer that was 7-fold over baseline, I would get imaging studies of my belly. I mean, we do it for mammograms, right? You have BRCA mutations. We're going to do mammograms on you. We're going to do them on a regular basis. The vigilance is heightened. Well, that's what we need to do for this. But we're not going to do it on everybody. We're going to do it on people who get an exome analysis. And in that exome analysis, I will tell you who's at risk and who deserves to be vigilant. So we also wanted to do this. For cancer screening, right, we have guidelines that come from all the health experts in the country for colon cancer, breast cancer. So what about bladder cancer? Is there one? No. Renal cancer? Not really. So the question is, why don't we try to screen for all kinds of cancers? It's maybe up to 30 cancers. So the problem is that the final confirmatory test for cancer is invasive and expensive, and the idea is we want to take people who are at risk and only then do the expensive and invasive tests. So there's a urine sample. Have you ever had blood in your urine? Sure. I've had urinary tract infections. You get blood in your urine. Think that's cancer? Probably not. Should I just say, okay, that's not it? It's probably a urinary tract infection. Yeah, could be bladder cancer. But here's the diagnostic test, sticking a steel rod through your urethra. Okay, no thank you. Or an imaging study, and we don't want to do too many of those either if we don't have to. So the answer is there's a whole bunch of tests, right? There's this test and that test. Many of you work for companies that have a new test, an ovarian test in here, right? An ovarian test, right? So the idea is somebody has to interpret it. You can't give it back to the doctor. Somebody at MD Anderson is working on a test for pancreatic cancer blood test, doing a test for something called Glypican 3. If you gave the result to a doctor for Glypican 3, they'd say, what the heck is that? But if you gave me the result for Glypican 3, because I've read 20 papers on Glypican 3, I will tell you what it means. It's the same thing as pharmacogenomics. It has to go through somebody who makes this sensible for everybody. And remember, a large language model, we translate everyone. This version to the doctor, this version to somebody at an 8th grade reading level. And they come out with the same information. So, it's on your iPhone, There it is. You're age 40. Time to look for an adrenal gland cortex tumor. Maybe that's cortisol levels. Maybe this is blood pressure for a week. But we are going to check blood in your urine every time. You're just going to be checked all the time. We're going to try to pick up cancer at stage one for every single thing you have. So that's for people who are not sick. If you are sick, it's different. Now, digital transformation in AP is a big deal, and you hear a lot more about this. It was earlier. That is since 1830, the microscope. And now we have screens, right? Big difference. And this is the coolest slide of all, right? So he said, well, maybe pathologists get it right. Maybe there's 5% where you said malignant, it was benign. And then there's the machine. Put them together, you get 100%. Now, wouldn't it be great? We digitize all our slides. And Harsh Thacker is head of AP at our place. Digitize. And now IBEX and Page AI now are putting out programs for individual kinds of tumors. So breast, lung, prostate, they're all emerging first. So we take it, and we're working with IBEX. And the goal is now it goes on, and you get a confirmation. You get a collaborator. You didn't send it to the Cleveland Clinic and wait 3 weeks. Not only that, we have the PacBio Revio. And we're going to do the genetics right there. So in a matter of a few days, we spent the money. That was an expensive instrument, but again, it was a $9 million grant. But the idea is to do these genetics right away. So there's a picture of it. Nice, big black box. If you're sick with a heart attack, a stroke, diabetes, coagulation, they're all in cardiometabolic. For people with anemia, autoimmune, these are the ones we do. All of these, except for the opioid toxicology, are still manual. But the opioid toxicology, remember, that told rapidly evolving. That was a month ago where we actually put together the whole thing from probing the record to here is the answer with a holy book. And now what we're doing is connecting these. And the AI team is getting bigger. These are the starting points. Unexpected benefits. Have you heard of pajama time? It's a term in the New England Journal of Medicine. Pajama time is I saw 14 patients today as a primary care doctor. And now I'm getting calls. People are saying, my ALT is a little elevated. And like you never go home. It's a horrible thing. I'm a primary care doctor. I have all these patients and they just keep calling me, right? We can end pajama time. Because we can tell you what an ALT that's slightly elevated means. We're partnering with a company called Elaborate that's trying to do this. We have a big problem with access to specialties. All those people in red shirts, they actually need a rheumatologist. But you'll notice there are people in white shirts and green shirts in the wrong line. They're trying to see the rheumatologist on the left. So what if we see the lab test? Remember, we're doing the workup. The ANA is negative, right? Now we get all the people in the red shirts to see the rheumatologist. And not only that, we say, before you see the rheumatologist, get these six tests done. So it turns out we can fix about half the cases. 33.7%, we calculated it, are in the wrong line and are waiting, by the way, 4 months in the wrong line. And 17.8% need the test done ahead of time, making a big difference. Now, what we realize, too, is that doctors are not going to do it because they think they know enough. This was one of the big problems that we decided with Academy of Medicine report, is that doctors think they know it, so they're not going to ask. So what we're doing is we're going to make triggers for every one of these. So the trigger is for coagulation. There's somebody says coagulation disorder. The patient's bleeding. There's a prolonged PTT. Whatever it is, it clicks up, and now it says, you want an expert interpretation of this work? And then after they read the first few, hopefully they'll say, I can't be without it. We're hoping that this will work in healthcare enterprises, academic medical centers, maybe individual pathologists at community hospitals, and, of course, for all these folks as well. So when I was buying my iPhone, trying to stay in the front of the line to get the new iPhone, I had this problem, right? And so we're not turning on any one of these DMTs until we can do 100 a day. I said, when we do 100 a day, then we're saying opioid toxicology is active, pharmacogenomics is active. They're all active now. But the reality is when we get to do 100 a day, we're going to make a billboard. So the original idea at 1984, right? Some of you not born. First implementation for COAG, Mass General, 1995. I started talking about it in 97 and 98. Thank you guys for letting me talk about it at your meetings. Creation of the diagnostic management team name was at Vanderbilt, 2010. We had three meetings, again, thanks, Bob, for 2017 to 19, then the pandemic came. And we've been implementing more and more DMTs. There was a woman who was going to be executed in the state of Texas, Melissa Lucio. You may have read about it. We have a child abuse DMT because one of the things that makes you think the child's been abused is a bruise. So we put them all through the child abuse DMT, and she was about to be executed 3 days away, and we stopped it. And as soon as they got it, they said, okay, maybe there's some that we have to look at. And we've reunited 41 families of people. Kids had von Willebrand disease. The trial stops in the middle. It's like, that is von Willebrand disease. That's it. You want to say something different? Show me why it's not. So, in 1889, they wanted to build the Eiffel Tower to make it the tallest structure in the world. And then they realized in 1887, that's as tall as it was going to get. And so, guess what happened in 2 years? In 2 years, they got wrought iron instead of steel or iron, so it wasn't as heavy. There were some new calculations that allowed them to get stability. And they didn't have to pound in the rivets by hand. They had pneumatic riveting. And they said, what? We can really build this thing. That's what happened to us, right? Been working on this all the time. 10 laboratory interpretations a day prepared manually, 500 a day, maybe 100 that we're going to do. So the limitations of the manual approaches is just too slow. We got this $9 million. We're hiring a lot of people. And if revenue generation occurs, we're going to hire more. Remember, Elizabeth Holmes got $9.2 billion. Wow, $9.2 billion. If you get us to $90 million, then every patient encounter with a physician in America can be changed. And so we have people who keep us on time with Gantt charts to get us done. The reality is that we in pathology do most of the tests, right? Radiology does some tests. Radiology earns a lot of money. This is the money generation. The technical side, mostly lab tests. Really, there's no way you can't put together pathology and radiology. I will say, because many of the tests are in pathology, so far we've been handling the puzzle pieces. So I'm the head of it. This is Peter. He's 36 years old. He's got a zillion titles. This is Chris Zahner, who writes all the holy books, puts together the holy books. He's 42 or something like that. And he was a mission control engineer and then went to med school. Very organized. Harsh Stacker's our AP guy. Juan, who wants to put this, he said, if America doesn't want it, Colombia does. That's where he's from. And he's director of operations. Brad Grant happens to be a lawyer as well as a doctor. Boy, is this a big help. The last meeting was all about lawyers. What do we do? And so he's our genetics guy. Heather is an anatomic person who's working with Harsh. Norma is our director of finance. Amin is from another institution, and we would invite you, if you have a special interest in something, maybe you will be a consultant because we can pay you. So if you are reading the literature and helping us build something, that's great. Melanie is our marketing person. Chris Welch and Carly and Stephanie make the trains run, as well as Gladson, and Victor takes the pictures. So thank you very much. That's our story.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.